The first reading this morning comes from Anne Lamont's brilliant little treatise on writing called Bird by Bird. This was written 13 years ago, and she is a terrific writer.
I think perfectionism is based on the obsessive belief that if you run carefully enough, hitting each stepping stone just right, you won't have to die. The truth is that you will die anyway, and that a lot of people who aren't even looking at their feet are going to do a whole lot better than you and have a lot more fun while they're doing it.
The second reading is an excerpt from a sermon given by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in 1968, just a few weeks before he was shot and killed. It concerns King David from the Hebrew Scriptures.
David, as you know, was a great king. And the one thing that was foremost in David's mind and in his heart was to build a great temple. David had the desire. He started. And then we come to that passage over in the 8th chapter of 1 Kings, which reads, "And it was in the heart of David my father to build a house before God. And the Lord said unto David my father, Whereas it was in thine heart to build a house unto my name, thou didst well that it was within thine heart." And that's really what I want to talk about this morning. It is well that it was within thine heart. As if to say, David, you will not be able to finish the temple. You will not be able to build it. But I just want to bless you because it was within thine heart. Your dream will not be fulfilled. The majestic hopes that guided your days will not be carried out in terms of an actual temple coming into being that you were able to build. But I bless you, David, because it was within thine heart. You had the desire to do it. You had the intention to do it. You tried to do it. You started to do it. And I bless you for having the desire and intention in your heart. It is well that it was within thine heart. So many of us in life start out building temples. Temples of character, temples of justice, temples of peace. And so often we don't finish them because life is like Schubert's unfinished symphony. At so many times we start, we try, we set out to build our various temples. And I guess that one of the great agonies of life is that we are constantly trying to finish that which is unfinishable. We are commanded to do that. And so we, like David, find ourselves in so many instances having to face the fact that our dreams are not fulfilled. And each of you this morning in some way is building some kind of temple. The struggle is always there. It gets discouraging sometimes. It gets very disenchanting sometimes. Some of us are trying to build a temple of peace. We speak out against war. We protest. But it seems that our head is going against a concrete wall. It seems to mean nothing. And so often as you set out to build a temple of peace, you are left lonesome. You are left discouraged. You are left bewildered. Well, that is the story of life. And the thing that makes me happy is that I can hear a voice crying through the vista of time saying, "It may not come today or it may not come tomorrow, but it is well that it was within thine heart." It's well that you are trying. You may not see it. The dream may not be fulfilled, but it's just good that you have a desire to bring it into reality. It's well that it's within thine heart.
One of the joys of working on a sermon to preach on this particular weekend is the sheer pleasure of getting to read so much of Dr. Martin Luther King's writings. And right he did. His collected papers are found in 5 thick books on the shelves of our downtown branch library. Volumes of his well-crafted sermons open up on another vista of the spiritual landscape of his mind and heart. He also wrote hundreds and hundreds of letters, including to folks I've never associated him with, like the singer Harry Belafonte. He seems to have lectured in secular settings even more than he preached in churches. He also was a noted scholar, crafting theological arguments for or against certain seminal religious thinkers of his era, like H. Richard Niebuhr or Paul Tillich. And he was articulate in areas that might surprise you, especially since all we usually ever hear about him at this time of year is that he had a dream. It's doubtful, however, that you will ever hear the following words, which Tom Balliol and I will use to open an adult classroom series this week on Tuesday on science and religion. These words come from King's 1963 book, Strength to Love, the same source as the affirmation. Soft-mindedness often invades religion. This has led to a widespread belief that there is a conflict between science and religion. But this is not true. There may be a conflict between soft-minded religionists and tough-minded scientists, but not between science and religion. Science investigates, religion interprets. Science gives humankind knowledge, which is power. Religion gives humankind wisdom, which is control. Science deals mainly with facts. Religion deals mainly with values. The two are not rivals. They are complementary. So, Dr. King was interested in a wide variety of topics and was articulate about many of them. But, visionary that he was, we do him no service if we set aside his immense capacity for realism. Prophet that he was, we do him a disservice if we ignore his practical human heart. Scholar that he was, we betray him if we lift up the brilliance of his mind without shining a spotlight on his down-to-earth soul. Dr. King had a dream, yes, and a good one. But he also understood that no dream comes to perfection today and tomorrow. He understood that perfectionism, the belief in the reality of a final utopia when all the conflicts of race and war and gender will be settled once and for all, is actually an escapist betrayal of that very dream. As far as I can tell, Dr. King never thought for a moment that some final paradise could be established once and for all in this world of ours. He felt it wasn't likely that human beings could ever know in advance and merely by intellectual imagination and affirmation what such a utopia could possibly and finally look like. And more importantly, what such a utopia would mean to and for our own souls, and what changes it might demand of us. As a man who considered himself a disciple of both Thoreau and Gandhi, he would have been clear that to paint the final portrait of some inevitable paradise in advance is only an example of self-congratulation. Nothing is inevitable, except, as Anne Lamont reminds us, our deaths. The future is shaped by our very real conflicts and conversations, not by mere affirmation of dreams, few of which, life tells us with reliable repetition, ever come to pass just as we imagine them. No, Dr. King was far more a realist than he was an idealist. However, Dr. King's realism and down-to-earth soul are often completely ignored. For example, King's critics falsely accused him of a foolish idealism, scolding him by saying, "You can't change human nature by simply passing just laws. You cannot legislate bigotry away." Listen to King's response, spoken right here in Ohio, up at Oberlin, in October of 1963. "It is true that behavior cannot be legislated, and legislation cannot make you love me. But legislation can restrain you from lynching me, and I think that's kind of important." In King's magnificent sermon, Unfulfilled Dreams, he speaks of the temple which the biblical King David was never able to get built. David tried and tried and tried, but obstacles kept on blocking his path. Finally, Dr. King notes in his sermon, and unlike Dr. King here, I will put this into modern English since I personally find the King James Version rather murky. "And God said to David, 'Since you had it in your heart to build a house for me, you did well, for the vision was steady in your heart.'" Steady in your heart. Now, if David had started to dump on himself for not having successfully built the temple, his vision would not have been steady in his heart. Instead, Dr. King would have said that his vision was occupying his heart like an enemy army. He would have said that David was being paralyzed by perfectionism. But fortunately, David was sensible enough to admit, without shame, that it simply wasn't going to happen. His vision remained steady for the rest of his life, but unexpected blocks to his visionary project were even steadier, and they eventually prevailed. Yet despite his failure to build the temple, the text affirms he did well. Note that the text does not say he did well enough. That would be perfectionism. Instead, it just says he did well. He's a good fellow. He lives beautifully. When Anne Lamont writes about perfectionism, she is speaking as a writer to writers about writing. But I think her insight is deeply spiritual and applies to what Dr. King was saying in his sermon. She reflects that perfectionism is an obsessive belief that if you run carefully enough, hitting each stepping stone just right, you won't have to die. The truth is you will die anyway, and that a lot of people who aren't even looking at their feet are going to do a whole lot better than you and have a lot more fun while they're doing it. You can't accuse Anne Lamont of timid writing. And somehow she seems to have come up with a well-nigh perfect piece of writing anyway. What I note is that she clearly recognizes perfectionism to be a spiritual problem. Psychologist David Richo defines the spiritual life as the continual shedding of illusions. Perfectionism, according to Lamont, is the state of refusing to shed the illusion that we can control everything, even our own mortality. If we get everything right, perfect, balanced, and all together, we won't have to suffer or break or die. We can control our lives and the whole world around us by our wishful thinking, our belief that we can get it all right and can stop having to worry, work, or wonder what's next. We'll be done. We'll be finished. We'll be complete. And we'll be really, really good. This utopian perfectionism worried Dr. King. He was baffled when certain people assured him they had totally left racism behind them. As if racism was only a business of separate water fountains, violent lynchings, and devious election shenanigans. Every single person I know repudiates such things, but I sure don't see utopia around me yet. No, racism is not best described as a series of horrible events, now perfectly repudiated, but rather as the uncritical stance of most folks who, by virtue of birth, are threats in this great American tapestry. It's the very atmosphere we breathe, not a little crabbed feeling of prejudice. It's a lack of self-awareness, not a specific list of nasty actions. Often people ask me why I use the phrase favored by the UUA, the Unitarian Universalist Association, anti-racist, when talking about the kind of spiritual work which dares to dream the same dream as Dr. King in his famous I Have a Dream speech. Isn't that word kind of negative, kind of defeatist? It's got the word anti in it. I'm asked, aren't we all past racism now? Aren't we all really, really good people? Well, my answer is this. I use that word precisely because of what Dr. King reminds me in his other dream sermon, the one you heard an excerpt of this morning, the one you probably have never heard of before. Dr. King was a realist and understood that if we actually thought we are close to perfection because of all the progress we have indeed made, then we are still holding tight to our illusions indeed. No, to work on becoming anti-racist is to admit that perfectionism, the idea that we can be finally done, finished, perfect, complete, and whole, is a self-serving and seductive illusion. And it is an illusion. So, to remain ever teachable, to remain ever capable of greater growth and greater depth, we are called, I believe, to lives of resistance. We are called to resist perfectionism, the belief that we cannot go any deeper in our self-reflections or that it's futile to do so. Let me offer you a simple example. When I have attended a service, a Sunday service or another service, at the African Methodist Episcopal Church Zion, down on Bryden Road, or Ephesians Church of God in Christ, out in Oakland, California, on Alcatraz Avenue, churches that are usually referred to as the historic black denominations, I can't help but to notice the way people dress. I notice that people there dress to the nines. I notice elegantly fine creases in trousers and tailored coats with beautifully crafted shoulder pads and sleek design. I notice remarkable outfits made of fine material that beguiles even my untrained eye. I notice hats, cuffling style sleeves on well-fitted shirts and creative styles. But when I attend a suburban church, United Methodist, Lutheran, Unitarian Universalist, or Catholic even, I notice a different dress code. Not one that is written down to be sure or even traditional, but one which would defend itself strongly or even crankily if it was criticized. I see a great diversity of styles from casual on up, but mostly casual, because the stress is rarely to dress up. The stress is usually on comfort and informality. Nothing wrong with that, mind you. It's just different from what you're going to find, definitely, at the AME Zion Church on Bryden Road. Thus, for me, to be anti-racist is not just to resist all the historic expressions of racism. All of us do that, as far as I can tell. But it's also to reflect deeply on more invisible things, more subtle things, if you will, like cultural differences within distinct historic communities. It's to be aware of them. It's to take them seriously. It's to dare to wonder aloud or inside you what life would look like in a truly well-integrated, multi-ethnic, multicultural, liberal, religious congregation. And to never assume that, were it to be this congregation one day, it would look just like it looks today. It's to dare to say that we are by no means perfected yet, nor is utopia in plain sight. But anti-racism also means to keep the still blurry but vivid vision of that utopian community alive in our hearts. It means to allow ourselves to be energized by that vision as we ask ourselves the deeper questions, questions of culture and questions of approach. It means to allow ourselves to be challenged by that vision as we ask questions which encourage us to be always and ever educable, resisting both ignorance and the seduction of perfectionism. And it's to remind ourselves daily that, as with King David, it is well with our hearts. It is well within our hearts. After all, Dr. King did not damn anyone for their unfulfilled dreams. He told them to keep dreaming, like King David, even though the temple will not be completed. The dream we have, the temple we are building, is not finished yet. But there is no shame in that. Do you hear me? There is no shame in that. And so to conclude with the great words of Dr. King, albeit altered to more modern English, each of you this morning in some way is building some kind of a temple. The struggle is always there, and it gets discouraging sometimes. It gets very disenchanting. Some of us are trying to build a temple of peace. We speak out against war, we protest, but it seems that our head is going against the concrete wall. It seems to mean nothing at all. And so often as you set out to build a temple of peace, you are left lonesome. You are left discouraged. You are left bewildered. But, Dr. King adds, the thing that makes me happy is that I can hear a voice crying through the vista of time, saying, it may not come today, or it may not come tomorrow, but it is well that it is steady within your heart. It is well that you are trying. You may not see it. The dream may not be fulfilled in your lifetime, but it's just good that you have a desire to bring it to reality. It's well that it's in your heart.